Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari.
On the show today, Simon Amstel, the writer, director, humorist and TV personality, will be talking us through his new film, Benjamin.
We'll also be hearing from Rachel Reeves, the MP and author whose new book, Women of Westminster, looks at the stories and achievements of female members of the UK Parliament.
And we'll be meeting Kadir van Lohausen, the photojournalist whose new exhibition, Arctic New Frontier, is highlighting global warming's effects on one of the world's most delicate ecosystems.
All that coming up, plus Monocle's Paige Reynolds will be looking ahead to next week's news today, and we'll play some new music as well, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Another busy week bites the dust, Org, and here we are, spending our Sunday lunchtime together in a way that I find unimprovable.
It's nice to see you again.
Always busy, of course, Monocle. Let's look ahead to the programme before us today, though. Now, they say, don't meet your heroes. You've thrown that piece of advice, that idiom, out of the window and sat down with Simon Amstel earlier this week. Was that a pleasure for you?
Yes, he was a charming and lovely man. And it was good to hear from him about his new film, which I have to say, I wouldn't be brave enough to make. It's a really penetrating insight into a character's neuroses which he himself has spoken about having. So, you know, I guess if it's a kind of autobiographical thing, I wouldn't feel that comfortable with everyone else looking at it. But he is, and he talks about it beautifully later.
And we'll hear from him in a bit. Now it's time to look ahead to next week's news today on the Weekly. Here comes Monocle's Paige Reynolds.
Everybody's talking from Paige News.
Hi, Paige. What have you got for us?
Well, Tom, this week, I'm going to be starting with Jair Bolsonaro, who will be arriving in the US today for a 3-day trip to the United States, where he will, of course, be meeting with Trump privately in the Oval Office. You know, Jair Bolsonaro has often been called the Trump of the tropics, so it looks like these two leaders might have quite a lot in common. Bolsonaro said on Twitter last weekend, it'll be a great opportunity to re-establish the strong ties between our nations in the quest for a Western hemisphere with freedom and prosperity. So what's going to be on the agenda? Well, the two largest economies are probably going to be discussing defence cooperation, pro-growth trade policies, combating transnational crime, and probably most importantly, restoring democracy in Venezuela. So I think, you know, both Brazil and the US have supported Guaido. The week before last, Bolsonaro hosted Guaido in Brazil. So I think perhaps their thoughts on this are going to count quite a lot in the international arena. So definitely stay tuned for that car crash. Next on the agenda, the UN's 2019 World Happiness Report is being published.
Go on.
Next Tuesday. Despite its perhaps twee title, it's become quite an important measure of citizen well-being across the world and often giving us kind of unexpected results. The old adage of money can't buy happiness being validated often, you know, the more prosperous nations such as US and Japan often falling further down in the rankings than we'd expect. The report defines a population's happiness as coming from six significant factors: GDP per capita, social support, life expectancy, freedom to make life choices, generosity and corruption levels. So quite an interesting mix. The 2018 report ranked 156 countries by the happiness levels and 117 countries by the happiness of their immigrants. And the 2019 iteration is also going to be focusing on the interrelation between migration and well-being. In 2018, Finland was the happiest country in the world.
I was about to say, I recall Finland topping the charts. Do we expect more of the same?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think it's been very much a Nordic top five since the report began in 2012. So Denmark, Iceland, Switzerland have all sort of come out on top. So
it's
perhaps
funny,
it will stay north.
We've got a Finn here, haven't we? And I've always thought he's very dour. But perhaps...
he's a curmudgeon, but I think he's deeply happy about it.
Yeah.
Perhaps that's the secret.
He's got a wry little note of mischief in his voice.
He's a pretty happy man. Paige, just a final note on this. Bhutan has a reputation of triumphing in these sorts of surveys of happiness because it bases the strength of its economy on gross national happiness rather than gross domestic product. Many economists believe that GDP is a poor indicator of wealth more broadly, and actually these other indices are more useful. And Bhutan consistently scores incredibly well. Another one to watch on your list when the new list is published.
More things to Google. And finally, one more story, quite a nice light light-hearted story. It is the Holi Festival of Colours next week. So this year, Holi begins on Wednesday and then ends the following evening. The Holi Festival of Colours, I'm sure most people are aware of it, but it's rooted in Hindu tradition. Some say from Vishnu legend, others say from Krishna legend. And it has lots of cultural significance as well. It's a time to end and rid oneself of past errors, to end conflicts by meeting others, a day to forget and forgive, settle debts and start afresh. It's sort of a spring cleaning for the soul. The celebrations start the night before with Holika Dahan, where people perform religious rituals in front of a bonfire and pray that their eternal evil be destroyed. And the next day, there is a free-for-all festival of colours, Rangwali Holi, where people smear each other with colours in this fine powder known as gulal. And I'm sure we've all seen the visuals are pretty fantastic, particularly, I think, in the Asian continent, in India, Nepal, India subcontinent.
Thank you, Paige. Lots of light and shade and colour brought to proceedings this week. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Simon Amstel. Don't go away.
As a face on UK TV, Simon Amstel's acerbic and acutely biting wit has gained him a devoted following. But the writer, comedian and director has seemingly mellowed a little in recent years. He's created thoughtful films that range from the futuristic satire Carnage, which imagined a world where the act of eating meat has become a distant thing of the past, to the semi-autobiographical Grandma's House, and stand-up specials like Numb.
His latest film is Benjamin, the tale of a young filmmaker navigating his career and love life and trying to strike some kind of balance between the two. Earlier, Org spoke to Simon about the film, but first, here's a clip.
It's been quite a while since Happy came out, which I love, by the way. I guess people will want to know why.
When people say that they like what you've done, it's best to just stop doing it or they could start hating you. Ideally, I'd have just made that film and died. Is that not a good answer?
I've made a film. I'm a film person.
What's it about?
My inability to love. But I'm fine now.
You're going to end up alone. You're going to end up unhappy.
I know this. I've written this. You're saying words I've actually written.
Oh, what are you doing?
So frigid.
So I'll start. You're not allowed to touch me.
This is it. Look, here it is again. The thin boy on stage.
You just like people who are well lit and weak, don't you?
I think he looked at me. You're really good at singing. Congratulations. And you're French too. That's exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so.
I'm a big fan of Les Mis.
Oh.
Benjamin is the story of a very successful young filmmaker who is about to release his second film, and he's terrified that it isn't going to go well. He has really high status anxiety. Really what he's looking for is the love of an audience. He just wants to feel safe. He just wants to feel like people love him enough so that he actually doesn't have to get involved in the murkiness of actual love. He's terrified of intimacy. He can't just love and be loved. He can't be in a moment with another human being without having to feel like he has to be really special. And you see him slowly throughout the film being broken down of that mania by this beautiful musician called Noah, who very patiently just encourages him out of his shell.
I'd like to talk about the music in a bit, but first, a lot of it feels very personal. A lot of the dialogue. And you've said that it's come from remembered relationships from your 20s, mm-hmm. that you're past that point that maybe Benjamin is experiencing. But where did it kind of start, the film?
I just started writing down dialogue from relationships I'd been in as a way of figuring out what was wrong with me, as a way of figuring out why none of those relationships really worked. And it turned out that I was just incapable of love. I was so defended. And you know, I was very successful. And didn't really need anyone, or that's how it felt. But I was also very lonely. It meant that I would seek relationships and would not be able to be in them. People would demand of me more than I was capable of giving at that time. I suppose that's where it came from. And I think I didn't know that I was writing about something so deep, actually. I didn't know that I was writing about intimacy or this inability to love. I thought I was just going to write quite a funny story, maybe a quite depressing story, actually, about loneliness. And it turned out to be quite a romantic, hopeful story about this guy who learns to love.
When you were kind of going through these memories and, you know, drawing from life, as you have in other places in your career, your series Grandma's House mm-hmm. was kind of semi-autobiographical. There's a very powerful scene where Benjamin encounters an ex, played very ably by Nathan Stewart Jarrett. and he gets called out on using moments from life mm-hmm. in his art. How have you found that? Has that ever cropped up?
What I found is that the people who were already angry in their life generally, they stay angry. and the people who were fine and supportive and loving stay that way. And I always feel like I would love to be fictionalized in something. I would love for somebody to write about me. I'd find it so flattering, and it would mean that they were paying attention. Like, I was dumped by somebody many years ago who went on to write an album, and I bought the album thinking, I imagine a couple of these songs will be about me. None of them.
None.
It was so upsetting. I thought, what do I have to do? Like, we were together for a while. Like, why? Give me one song. give me something.
Were you even in the liner notes?
Nothing. There was no thank you. You know, nothing.
That's cold, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. And then I saw a picture of him after a gig being hugged by somebody who had also rejected me. I thought, oh my God, there's no way that one of them's saying, how's Simon?
In the film, Benjamin has like a range of tics that he draws on. At home, he watches all these self-help videos. How do you engage with those? Is that kind of that mode of spirituality something that you find helpful?
Yes. Benjamin's problem is maybe that he only watches stuff about Buddhism on YouTube, whereas I've read a few books. A few. And he also thinks that he can just use some of that wisdom from the monk for his film to make it more profound, and it ends up just being more pretentious. And that's what Marc Kermode says quite accurately. For me, I've found it to be very helpful, that kind of stuff. Yeah, in terms of Buddhism, I guess I learned quite early on about karma and compassion. Everything I do, I think, tends to be quite compassionate. I did a film a couple of years ago set in the future, looking back at a time when people ate other animals. And it was a very compassionate look at how people in the past, from that film's perspective, but in the present, from reality, are just doing what they think they're supposed to be doing. They're just doing the normal thing. And because we have that compassionate angle, which is all from Buddhism, really, I think the film was quite digestible and funny. I think it was funny to show people in a group therapy session talking about the shame that they feel now about eating a baby lamb in the past, like the terrible guilt that they have. And that's the same when you're writing characters, I suppose, for something like this film, Benjamin. You only really know them, you only really figure out who they are from empathy. If you are coming at it from this judgmental place, which is a really inaccurate place to be, because if you're being judgmental, it suggests that you are better than other people and you know something that they don't know. And we're all idiots. I mean, the whole thing is, when I'm writing, it tends to be, I'm trying to figure out, why am I this idiot? What have I done? Or what could I have done to be less stupid? So it's a very self-deprecating process for me. And I think a lot of that comes from this Buddhist idea, this compassion. And I think a lot of it's from that. And thinking of stuff beyond the physical, beyond just what your perceptions are telling you. I think that comes from that.
With that said, though, does writing offer you a kind of opportunity to, I don't know, grind an axe a bit? There's
not
lots
really.
Of like archetypal twits in this, the performance art
right,
scene.
Right, well, that's
kind
true.
Of definitely
yeah, certainly. Yeah, when I went
to
see
to
that
art school.
Piece of So when I went to see that piece of performance art, contemporary dance, it was a very isolating, lonely moment for me, because this dancer was doing this thing that was so absurd, and when she finished, nobody laughed, and I thought, am I insane to think this is ridiculous? And so when you come to fictionalizing that moment from your life, I don't think it's revenge, but it's quite satisfying, because you feel like the world makes sense again. You feel like you've put it in the context that it was supposed to be put in the first place.
I said we mentioned the music. James Wrighton, who was in the Klaxons,
yes.
is now a songwriter, musician.
Yeah, he's got a solo project called Shock Machine. He's about to release a new album just under his name, because it's quite a personal album.
You know, the music was really good, which kind of surprised me a bit, because have you seen that Velvet Buzzsaw that's come out on Netflix?
No.
It's about art, but all the art in it isn't very good.
Right.
And like in Freedom by Jonathan Franzen, all of the lyrics, like, it's quite hard to make music within or art within a film convincing and two-dimensional. And I wondered how you went about doing that. I heard you wrote the music together.
Yeah, I wrote the lyrics, he wrote the melody. I'm trying to think how we did that, because you're right. I think we probably thought about how we didn't think about writing songs for a character. James put himself in the position of being this student band leader because he's been in that position before. And I wrote these lyrics from a place of wanting to express something. It wasn't just, there's a scene that needs a song, let's write a song. It was, what would Noah be singing about at this point? And it wasn't even what would Noah be thinking. I think it was just, I've got these lyrics. I think we just wrote the songs from our hearts is probably the answer. We just wrote from our hearts. There you go.
And then Phoenix Brossard, should I say, who plays Noah, has a lovely voice. And that was Happy Chance, was it?
Yeah, it was really, I mean, it was really hard to find somebody who had everything. He's beautiful and he's so effortless in his acting. It doesn't look like acting. And his chemistry with Colin is amazing. It's just so beautiful and romantic, the whole thing. And then he can sing. And he sings in a way that's, James kept thinking of him as a sort of young Pete Doherty. He's got this kind of huskiness and, you know, he's not singing like Adele, but he's got this, you know, this really cool indie singer vibe.
Yeah. How do you feel when people see your films?
Well, when it premiered at the London Film Festival, it was a relief that everyone was laughing throughout, apart from during the sad bits where they did other noises that made me feel good. I suppose it makes me feel like I'm not insane to have thought it was a good idea to spend 5 years trying to make this thing. And I feel connected. I think for Benjamin, for his character, the results of what he does are everything, and he's forgotten about the joy of doing the thing that he loves to do. And for me, having got a bit better after a lot of therapy, I am now in a place where I love doing the thing that I'm doing when I'm doing it. And then when it comes to a screening and I'm there with people, it feels like it's not about, it feels like it's not about attaining some status, but it's about feeling the connection that the film is making. So when they laugh, I feel like, oh, that's, yeah, good, because I thought that was funny. And when they feel sad, I think yeah, that, oh yeah, it was actually based on something that made me feel sad. So it's amazing that feeling.
Do you think then that this is a kind of, maybe it was not, it was kind of post cathartic, as like a kind of letter to someone that you have been, or a set of feelings that you have experienced from the position of no longer being there? Or did you kind of work through things as you went along?
Yeah, a bit of both. Certainly when I started writing it, I didn't know what the ending could be because I didn't know exactly what the problem was. And then when we were shooting it, I discovered more stuff. And then I'd be in the edit and I'd be thinking things like, oh, that poor guy. Oh my God, he's such a maniac. Wow. That's, and I think, you know, I developed this kind of compassion for my younger self, thinking about what I was like. I was actually wandering around like that with all those bizarre thoughts. And I suppose a feeling like that change is possible. There's proof that change is possible. I'm not exactly like that anymore. I've got older. I'm wiser. I'm all right now. I'm in a relationship. Everything's just a lot more healthy and less fuzzy in my head than it used to be.
Mm. I know you mentioned Carnage just now, which is the BBC film about veganism.
I like to say it's about carnism.
About carnism, yeah.
Sure.
That's better. That obviously comes from a slightly different place, but with Grandma's House, with Benjamin, they're very intimate films and kind of there's a domesticity to them, to the scale. Is that something, do you feel like you've kind of done that now? Do you want to do something bigger, or is it just something that's always interesting to you?
I don't think I think about the size of stuff, but I feel like I've maybe done that aspect of my 20s. Mm. And I think there's probably something to be written about being in a long-term relationship and what, you know, the difficulties of that. And I feel like I'll always want to try and figure out what's going on in my head. All the things that, what I've learned from stand-up is that I get a lot out of the process of feeling really scared or confused or ashamed of something, feeling like I can't tell anyone ever, otherwise bad things will happen, and then saying the thing out loud and hearing laughter come back, which for me sounds like, that laughter, it feels like either people are saying, oh, we all feel that. That's great. Thank you for saying it. That's, oh, good. We can all feel less lonely now. Or they're saying, that's quite strange. But we're still here laughing. And so either way, there's not the rejection that you think you're going to get from telling the truth. Actually, the truth sets you free. So I think I'll always want to do that, as well as something like Carnage, which is just me wanting to say something about the world.
Simon Amstel, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
I love Monocle Weekly.
Simon Amstel there, talking to Augustin Macellari. And do check out Simon's new film, Benjamin. It's out now. Time for music now. This is from the soundtrack to Benjamin, which those two were just discussing, with music by James Wrighton and lyrics by Simon Amstell and sung by Phoenix Brossard. This is Give Me Something.
Give me something I can be. Give me someone I can feel more than delight. I don't want to look at me. There's something with me that I won't forget tonight.
Give Me Something There, sung by Phoenix Brossard, written by James Wrighton, and Simon Amstell from Simon's new film, Benjamin. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. British Labour Party MP Rachel Reeves is also an author, and her new book, Women of Westminster, looks at the roles that female members of Parliament have played throughout political history in this country. It also asks how we can make politics a fairer environment in the future.
Earlier, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Rachel Reeves about the book.
So I've been a Member of Parliament for 9 years now, and I partly wrote the book because a few years ago I wrote about one of my predecessors in Leeds, a woman called Alice Bacon, who was an MP there for 25 years and the only woman to represent any of the Leeds seats before I got elected in 2010. When I was researching her life, I felt very much her story needed to be told and more people should have heard it. And yet so many women get written out of our history, not just our political history, but more generally. And so the idea of this book was to rewrite some truly remarkable women, women pioneers, back into our political history. And I hope that's what I've achieved with this book.
Absolutely. And Rachel, I want to talk about some of the characters in the book. I was also talking to our team today. I mean, you tell me that, but being like a woman MP or a politician anywhere, it is tough because the type of criticism that people seem to do, even from my own country, Brazil, when we had a female president, Dilma, the type of things that people would say to her, they wouldn't do it to a man in a way. Do you think that's the case? There's still lots kind of a prejudice in that sense.
Yes, I think that things have improved hugely in the 100 years that we've had women in Parliament, and we've come an awful long way from no women MPs 100 years ago today to having 209 today. But if you look at the sort of gendered language that we still use in politics, if you look at the abuse that MPs get on social media, the abuse is particularly targeted at women MPs, whether they are on the left or the right, whether it is Anna Soubry and the abuse that she's had over Brexit, whether it's the abuse that Diane Abbott gets as a black woman, the first black woman to be elected to Parliament, or the abuse Luciana gets as a Jewish woman. It's totally unacceptable. But the proportion of abuse that is targeted at women hugely outstrips that which male MPs have to endure. No one should have to endure it, but it's not right that women are particularly targeted in this way.
That's very much so. Talking about the book, I mean, let's start with an amazing story of Nancy Astor. She was the first woman MP in Parliament back in 1919. Not all women could vote by then.
So in 1918, some but not all the women were given the vote, or won the right to vote. They weren't given it, they won the right to vote. And you had to be over 30, you had to meet some property qualifications. So poor, younger, working class women were not able to vote. You had to be over 30. For men, it was any man over the age of 21. You didn't have an equal franchise until 1928, 10 years later. It's actually an interesting case of Jenny Lee, who was elected in the 1920s as a Labour Member of Parliament in Scotland. And she was old enough to stand as an MP because you had to be over 21 to stand. But she wasn't actually old enough to vote for herself because she wasn't yet 30. So you had this sort of interesting situation where a woman could stand age 21, but she couldn't actually vote until she was 30 in many cases.
And it's interesting in your book, I mean, of course, you're a Labour MP, but you also talk about, you know, the Conservative Party. I think that's quite nice. I mean, I believe even Theresa May mentioned your book on Prime Minister's Questions, right?
So yes, in Prime Minister's Questions, I was sort of sitting there minding my own business. And then the Prime Minister referred to my book coming out for International Women's Day, which was really wonderful. And I have tried in the book, I interviewed the Prime Minister for it. I interviewed Amber Rudd and a number of other Conservative MPs, including Gillian Shepherd and Edwina Curry, who were members of parliament and ministers back in the 80s and 90s. So I've tried to tell the story from across the political spectrum. I may not agree with everything that the Conservative women have done. Nancy Astor herself was a Conservative woman when she was elected in 1919. But I still think we should celebrate the successes of people who we might not agree with on everything. And one of the wonderful things that I learnt about from researching the book was the extent to which women MPs over the last 100 years have worked together on issues that affect the lives of women outside. So Nancy Astor, Conservative, worked very closely with Margaret Wintringham, a Liberal MP, to change the law on the guardianship of children. Up until the mid-1920s, women had no rights at all over their children in the case of separation or divorce. And they changed the law so that there was equal guardianship of children. That was a fantastic reform. And it was something that the male MPs in Westminster hadn't thought about at all. Margaret Wintringham said in her speech that she wanted the male MPs in the chamber to imagine themselves as a woman who had no rights over her own child. And of course, that's very difficult for men. It's very difficult for anybody to put themselves in other people's shoes. That's why you need MPs from a variety of backgrounds in Parliament to represent the whole wonderful diversity in our country. So that means more women in Parliament. It means more people from black and minority ethnic backgrounds, more people who are LGBT, more people with disabilities, because Parliament is supposed to represent the country as a whole. And you do bring, I know this, you bring to Parliament your own experiences as well as those of your constituents.
And tell me a little bit more about your job as an MP. You were there since 2010, I believe.
Yes, that's right. I worked as an economist before I was an MP, so it was quite a change for me. I joined the Labour Party when I was at school, and that was because when I was at school in the 80s and 90s, there were never enough textbooks to go around. Our library was turned into a classroom at school because there wasn't enough space for all the children that were supposed to be educated there. Our sixth form was two prefab huts in the playground. And I felt very strongly that the Conservative governments that I had grown up under, I was just 3 months old when Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister, that they didn't represent families like mine, communities like mine, and didn't put our interests first. And so that's why I got involved in politics. And it's still those issues of equality that motivate me today as a Member of Parliament. I would like to see more Labour members of Parliament. I would like to see a Labour government. My whole 9 years as an MP, we've had Conservative governments. But I also want to see more women in Parliament, because I think it's really important that the talents of women, at the moment, you're still twice as likely to be an MP if you're a man than a woman. Two-thirds of Parliament is male, just over two-thirds is male. I would like to see in my political lifetime a 50-50 parliament, as many men and women there.
Hopefully it's not going to be a long way for that. But I'd like to ask, was there a breaking point in terms of female representation in Westminster, perhaps post-Second World War with the Labour government?
Yes, I think there were two turning points. I think that the first was 1945 and the second was 1997. So in 1945, 24 women were elected to Parliament. That may not sound like a lot today when we're talking about 209, but it was a huge leap from the eight women MPs in Parliament before the Second World War. So that was a huge leap. And there was a lady members room, which is where the lady MPs, women MPs, were supposed to work. And it just had seven desks in it. And in 1945, when 24 women turned up, it was hugely overcrowded and they had to start finding other accommodation for the women. So that was a big turning point. They outgrew the room where they were allocated. The other big turning point, of course, was 1997, when 101 Labour women were elected and 121 women overall in that 1997 Parliament. And that was a huge step forward. Now, that was in part because of the Labour landslide, but it was also because people hadn't expected Labour to win quite as many seats as they did. And that was true in 1945 as well. Often women are selected for marginal seats, seats that they probably won't win. And in 1945 and 1997, Labour exceeded expectations of how well they would do in the polls. And as a result, a lot of women in marginal seats came into Parliament for the first time. But there is an issue that women are often selected, including actually Margaret Bonfield, who was the first woman in the cabinet under Ramsay MacDonald in the 1920s. She was selected in Northampton, which had a 5,000 Conservative majority. She overturned that and gave a majority for Labour of over 4,000. But it's another example of women being selected for seats that the parties don't necessarily expect to win. And as a result, women's parliamentary careers can be cut short when the mood in the country changes.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but in terms of like women's rights, I think even the type of language that we use might have changed. Because of course, 97, was it the name, the Blair's Babes, or the Cameron Cuties? I have a feeling, I might be wrong, I mean, you tell me, but this type of language in 2019 wouldn't happen? I mean, the press wouldn't have those type of names?
Well, one would hope not, but if you look at you know, some of the commentary about what Theresa May wears, her kitten heels, her brown leather trousers that she wore for an interview, Ken Clark, obviously a male MP, former Chancellor and father of the House, said that he was pleased to be a man because no one's ever interested in what he wears, recognising that there's often a lot of interest in what women wear. Luciana Berger, I think, counted the number of articles that commented on her nail varnish colour, for example, and often described her as having raven-coloured hair, which may be factually accurate, but not perhaps that relevant to what she's saying as a Member of Parliament. So I think there is still a lot of commentary on what women wear, and that's been true for 100 years. So when women first got elected, when Nancy Astor first got elected in 1919, there was a lot of speculation about whether she would wear a hat or not when she spoke in the House of Commons, because at that point, in public meetings, women showed respect by keeping their hats covered, whereas when men rose to speak, they took their hats off. And the Times speculated that no doubt she will want to cover her head when she speaks. And then the Daily Express newspaper, always a bastion of progressive journalism, said something like, hat problem still unsolved. And it wasn't solved until 1929, when the Speaker ruled that in future women did not need to cover their heads to speak. But for 10 years, there was lots of speculation in the press, in the Times, to the Daily Express, about whether women should wear hats or not. And, you know, we've moved on from that. Some of my colleagues were saying the other day that maybe we should, in a sign of solidarity with our women forebears, all turn up to Parliament one day in our beautiful hats. But the debate has moved on from hats, but I still think there's a lot of discussion, too much discussion, on women's looks and what they wear.
But when it comes to women in politics, how would you compare the UK with other countries? Because, I mean, look at the US. I mean, they never had a female president. I mean, they tried Hillary. Countries like France or Italy as well, I think they're quite far away from that as well.
This is a global problem. It's not just a problem in the UK. If you look at the G20, for example, I think I'm right in saying it's just Angela Merkel and Theresa May who are the female leaders of their countries. Harriet Harman, when I interviewed her for my book, says that she was invited to the wives' dinner at the G20 reception when London hosted the G20. And she wasn't sure how to reply, because just because she was a woman didn't make her the wife of a politician. She was a politician in her own right. She was Deputy Prime Minister or Deputy Leader of the Labour Party at the time. So, you know, this isn't just a UK issue. This is a global problem. And certainly when Hillary Clinton ran for president, there was an awful lot of gendered language about her, which I just can't help thinking it does put off women. Although, if you look at the next US presidential race, lots of women seem to be putting themselves forward for that. I think that's a great thing. And it would be a truly wonderful thing, in my view, if we had a woman president of the United States. And in our country, I would like to see a woman leader of the Labour Party. And I would also like to see a female Chancellor of the Exchequer, because there are still barriers that need to be broken through in this country and, of course, around the world.
Maybe Rachel Reeves?
You never know, but not right now. But, you know, on the Labour benches, 45% of our MPs are women. So there's plenty of talent to choose among. And so I hope that the Labour Party can end its 120 years of selecting men to lead our party and next time select a woman.
I mean, that would be amazing. And finally, Rachel, I would like to know, of course, you wrote about these amazing women. Do you have any personal heroes when it comes to the world of politics, especially women?
The woman who I was just so impressed with and really inspirational was Ellen Wilkinson. And Ellen Wilkinson was first elected in 1924. She led the Jarrow Crusade from Jarrow in the northeast of England down to London, marching against the poverty and high levels of unemployment in the community she represented. And she went on to be the Secretary of State for Education under Clement Attlee, an incredibly reforming Labour government. And in that role, she raised the school leaving age from 14 to 15 and introduced free school milk for children at schools. So I really think she is a heroine of mine, and I hope that if people read the book, they'll learn more about her story and what a huge difference she made.
Rachel Reeves there, discussing her book Women of Westminster with Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. Much is said of the threat that climate change poses to the planet, but often its tangible effects are only really understood when we hear from those living on the front lines. Getting to grips with that was the goal of photographers Yuri Kozirev and Kadir Van Lohausen, veteran photojournalists who recently travelled across the Arctic to capture images of a region in flux, a trip made possible with the assistance and funding from the Carmignac Photojournalism Award, which the duo are recipients of.
Their new book, Arctic, New Frontier, is available now, and it's accompanied by a photography show with the same name, currently at London's Saatchi Gallery. Earlier, Kadir von Lohausen joined Augustin and Monocle's Robert Bowne to talk about the section of the duo's journey he made, beginning in Norway, crossing Greenland, and finishing in Alaska.
It was a challenge on the many fronts, but this is really about climate change and what's happening in the Arctic and what will be the impact of the rest of the world. That's what we were looking at. But we had to shoot this mainly in the Arctic summer, which is still relatively short. We needed the landscape with no ice. So the period we were shooting was actually shorter than 6 months, I would say, was July up till October. But yes, it's a project which I did with my colleague, Yuri Kozirev, who's Russian, I am Dutch. We both worked in the Arctic before, and we both noticed how quickly it was changing, actually. You know, I mean, we all know about climate change, and we know about that the sea level is rising and that the temperatures need to go down. But in the Arctic, everything goes 2-3 times faster. So that was also, you know, why we wanted to work there, because it's very visible. We worked both in the Arctic before. We were talking about doing a collaborative project together before, because we felt that Yuri would have a better access to the Russian Arctic than I would have, and I would have a better access to the Western Arctic than he would have. The stumbling block was always expenses, mainly, because it's an incredible, not only difficult region to work in, but also a very expensive region to work in. So once a year, there's this big French photojournalism prize is being given, and every year there's a theme to it. So last year, the theme was the Arctic. So we knew we had to write a proposal and submit.
It's quite it's obviously a fighty topic. In the name of the show, the name of your book is New Frontier. Did it feel like that at the time? Did it feel like kind of, I get a Wild West vibe from the name and from some of the photographs, that there is opportunity, there is kind of a bit of a gold rush?
There's definitely, I would call it the Wild North. If you realize really what's happening, I mean, we all grew up with a globe where there's a white spot on the top of the world and there's a white spot at the bottom of the world. And if the predictions are correct, which are that the Arctic, the ice of the North Pole, will be melted completely in 11 years, 2030, that there will be no ice in the summer anymore, is kind of a strange concept.
You can't imagine it.
You cannot imagine it, and I think the main issue is that people don't realize what the impact will be. Because first of all, you know, I mean, the ice, snow, is white, so it reflects the sunlight, it reflects the warmth. So the North Pole is really our air conditioner, it's our fridge, it keeps us cool. Not only the Arctic region, but also us, England, Holland, Western Europe and most of the Northern Hemisphere. If this melts, it means that the sunlight gets absorbed in the ocean, and the oceans which are heating up already will heat up even quicker. We never really looked up north, you know, it was this barren landscape where very few people lived. And nowadays, with the melting of the ice, you know, I mean, new sea routes become available. New mineral resources are becoming available. Oil and gas reserves are becoming available. There's a huge increase in tourism in the region. Not to forget, it's getting militarized.
One of the pictures that I think of when you talk about the militarization of it are that kind of Canadian strike team on their skidoos, which is something that clearly would not have had to have happened, or not be possible to have even used that sort of craft to whiz around on the ice, presumably up until a certain point. They're a kind of fresh fresh frontiers sort of militarily being drawn.
Yeah, you know, I mean, those frontiers were maybe there to some extent during the Cold War. But after the collapse of the Soviet Union, nobody really paid attention anymore. But now it is, you know, I mean, where Yuri traveled in the Russian Arctic is almost all a military zone. So he needed special permits to be there and to work there. The Canadians never really, they had some presence, but never as large as they have now. I just came back actually from the Norwegian Arctic, where I spent time with the Dutch Marines, who have 800 Marines now stationed there during the winter, and they are training together with the Brits, the Americans, the Belgians, and the Germans. And it's a fighting mission, right? Mm. So the question which came up to us as well is who the Arctic actually belongs to. Because if the Arctic melts, it's an ocean, and an ocean is international waters. Mm. There's normally maritime laws which apply, which have a 12-mile zone and a 200-mile zone, and then it's international waters. But as you may recall, already in 2007, it was the Russians who planted a flag under the ice very far from the coast of Russia and said, this is where the Russian continental shelf ends. So that's basically what you see happening, especially with all the resources which are more or less becoming available.
It seems quite cartoonish to remember that, and it plants a flag under the ice. And now there are kind of floating power stations and all sorts of kind of things, sort of a lot of heavy gear that is being brought up there and installed and made to be almost land where there isn't going to be any land or any ice. Is that how it feels?
That's definitely how it feels. And yes, it remains a very remote region. But what was striking for us, if you compare the images of Yuri and you compare the images of me, is how advanced the Russians are. It has a history to it, because during the Soviet Union, they developed the Arctic already. In the end of the day, it's their only access to the ocean. But that kind of fell apart after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But, you know, I mean, if you compare it, like the Americans, so Alaska, Canada, they don't have any deep sea ports. There's hardly any infrastructure. There are no cities, big cities. And the Russians, it's the opposite. They're big cities, there's infrastructure, they're deep sea ports. It's really well developed. I mean, the Americans and the Canadians together have like a handful of icebreakers, which are quite old and need to be replaced. The Russians have 60 icebreakers, of which most of them are brand new.
We've been hearing about the threat of climate change, certainly for most of my life, but it's really taken on this added urgency over the last 3 years. Now it's only a handful of radicals who deny its effects. But I guess this shift that you've seen here, the retreat of the ice, can't have been that sudden. Did it surprise you how developed this infrastructure that you're talking about, apart from the Russian infrastructure, but more broadly, how quickly people have leapt on it as an opportunity? Or did it indicate that, in fact, this is something that has been happening for a fair few years, but we just haven't noticed?
I mean, it's all speeding up, right? If we get numbers of how fast the sea level is rising, how quickly the glaciers are retreating, how quickly the ice sheet is melting, it's always worse than what was said before. Some people have been looking at the Arctic and saw this coming, you know? I mean, the Russians, they've been trying to open the northern route for many years. But
got a lot of icebreakers.
Yeah. So for them, it's a real given. It's a gift to them that this is happening.
And in terms of, we talked about the climate change itself and how you worked and all the rest of it. In terms of the work, in terms of the pictures that we'll see in the gallery and that we can see in the book, what was people's attitude to being photographed? Did you have to sort of persuade them of the project that you were doing? Did you tell them the truth about the project you were doing? Were they suspicious? Did they not want to necessarily be part of this? And there's indigenous people, there are Russians, there are Canadians, there are all sorts of people that you've shot.
Yeah, I mean, it was very different.
Differently.
It was very different. So, you know, people reacted differently, but it was definitely one of the most difficult projects either of us did, because there's a lot happening there which people rather don't want to show. So if mining companies, oil and gas, you know, I mean, it's all not necessarily all regulated. So access was incredibly difficult for indigenous native communities. You really needed an introduction and needed to be with someone local. I mean, people are suspicious because they get reported quite a lot, but it's always in a negative way. It's always about alcoholism, suicide, drugs abuse, but not very often the question is asked, where is this actually originating from? So it's understandable for definitely from their side why they are reluctant. But I think, you know, we had a case to make. We also had we put it into a context. It didn't necessarily grant us access, but we were always honest about what we were doing and why. And I think what made it unique is that it's two of us looking from a global perspective at the Arctic simultaneously. So, you know, there's lots has been said over the years about the Arctic, but it's always bits and pieces and about a specific area or region. Now we looked from a global perspective both, and I think especially if you see the Russian side and the Western side next to each other, it gives a different perspective. And I think, you know, I mean, there's some positive side effects for the Arctic, that the climate is changing, you know. I mean, the new sea routes could be positive in a way that the travel time for commercial shipping from Western Europe to Asia will be shortened by 16 days. So we will, you know, it's better for the environment, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, you know, I mean, it's a very volatile, fragile region. Any accident that could happen, any oil spill, will have a huge impact on the region.
You've done many long trips, long projects over the course of your career. What is it about taking 6 months, 10 months to engage with an issue or a set of issues that is important for your method?
I'm a freelancer, so, you know, I have to be like any journalist or photojournalist. You have to be unique in the stories you're trying to tell. You know, I mean, there's no necessity for me to tell a story which I've been told or shown before. I think also looking at the media, you know, I mean, there's very few media which will dedicate the money and the time we have spent on this project or other projects to issues which are, you know, I feel they are very necessary, you know. I mean, they're very necessary to document, and whether it will wake up people or something will happen is a different story. But, you know, I mean, for the last couple of years, my stories have been much more focused on climate change, on the issues about the rising sea level, about waste management or mismanagement, about the Arctic, about water scarcity. It's huge issues which I don't think that people realize what kind of an impact this will have for future generations, you know. And it's interesting to see now. I mean, like last weekend, there was a big climate march in Amsterdam. 40,000 people showed up, where the weather was the worst ever. There's almost an uprising of a young generation, right? They are fed up with us. We are wasting this planet. How is this possible with all the science and all the scientific proof that we still let this happen and that we don't act? For me, it's mind-boggling. I do what I do and hope it will contribute something.
And obviously you've got that journalistic eye and that desire to make something new or have your own take on something that is old, at least. You talked about, remember the time when the globe had a sort of white patch on the bottom and a white patch on the top. Do you feel sentimental about that, or do you feel that it is just right that that should be the case? I wonder also about your project about the seven great rivers, following them from source to sea, whether you maybe were one of the last people to document that as it was in the past somehow.
You know, I don't want to be sentimental about it.
I'm just wondering whether that's an okay thing to be when you're a photographer, when you can actually, you can try and protect some of the beauty of things in a picture.
Yeah, and it's not just about the beauty, you know, it's this white patch is a necessity. Mm. And yes, okay, climate skeptics will say, well, the sea has been much higher than before, has been much lower than before. We had ice ages. There was a time that the pole wasn't there. But when these, and it's true, but when these changes happened, it took thousands of years, many, many generations. And so the adjustment was possible, was slow. People were more nomadic than they are now. And now we think that everything is possible, right? I mean, I'm living in Amsterdam. I'm living below the sea level.
So
the
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, so. I mean, so the Dutch, you know, I mean, we invested centuries. We invested in coastal protection, in our dikes, in our water management. But also the Dutch are now being warned recently in a report, which was actually made, or was the Ministry of Infrastructure asked the company to make this report, where the Dutch are being warned now that by the end of the century, that the sea could rise by 1 to 3 meters. That means there's no Amsterdam, there's no The Hague, there's no Rotterdam. It's urging the Dutch to think about a plan B, and a plan B could be to retreat. And that's just for people to think about that, and we could lose a city like Amsterdam, which is very historical, is kind of a shocker. Mm. But you know, I mean, it needs to become part of this. Same for London.
Okay, yeah. So no sentiment then? There's no room for sentiment in your
world? Well, there's a sentimental urgency, let's put it that way.
All right, well said.
Thank you, Kadir. The Arctic New Frontier book, in conjunction with the Carmagnac Photojournalism Award, is available now. And if you're in London, really do go along and see the exhibition at the Saatchi Gallery. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. And what a show that was, Tom.
Food for thought, that's what we like to serve up here on the Monocle Weekly. It's a Sunday lunchtime, after all. Let's thank the chefs behind the glass. The programme was produced by Tom Hall and Augustin Macellari, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. My thanks to them all. The Monocle Weekly will be back at the same time next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Augustin Macellari. Goodbye.
And thanks for listening.